ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And on the other side of the pyramid are the carbohydrate foods like bread, pasta, rolled oats, and bricky cereals like Weet-Bix.
This is Andrea, and she's an expert on food. She's been explaining to us how to combine the various foods to make healthy eating.
And she uses this diagram called the Healthy Food Pyramid to explain it.
For those of a certain age, I'm sure you can picture it, the Healthy Food Pyramid, so often seen on the walls of classrooms, doctor's offices in the 1980s and 90s. Those kids we just heard learning about the pyramid, that was on the ABC in 1988. Do you remember how it works? Yes, that's right. The foods at the base are the ones you should eat most. Veggies, beans, fruits, cereals. Meat and dairy were in the middle. Fats, sugars at the top, the foods you should eat the least. The United States introduced its own pyramid in 1992, and 20 years later, under Barack Obama, it became a plate, said to be simpler, easier to understand. Australia, well, it did the same. But now, of the Obama years, a distant memory, the pyramid is back in the USA.
This is what it takes to make America healthy again. Under the leadership of President Trump, we are reclaiming the food pyramid and fixing a system that has been broken for far too long.
And when they say reclaiming the pyramid, they also mean flipping it on its head.
A new framework centers on protein and healthy fats, vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. And you can see the food pyramid here. It's upside down, a lot of you will say. But it was actually upside down before, and we just righted it.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Donald Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services, announcing the changes. So what's driving these new dietary guidelines? Do they hint at what Australians might expect from our new guidelines due here later this year? And why are some dietitians concerned about the new US pyramid? When actually the guidelines address the dangers of ultra-processed food in a way Americans have never seen before.
Highly processed foods loaded with additives, added sugar, and excess salt damage health. And they should be avoided. My message is clear: eat real food.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's all about food and the places where food, culture, science, and history collide. This week, the food pyramid gets flipped. What other shapes do we see around the world?
So Canada has a rainbow, which I think is really cool. Aww. And then my favorite is Guatemala has an olla familiar, which is a traditional earthenware cooking vessel that they use in Guatemala. That one's really pretty and beautiful too.
My name is Casey Highsmith, and I'm an independent food scholar and researcher.
Let's talk food pyramids, Casey. Where did that idea of the food pyramid come from anyway?
So we've been grouping nutritional components for well over a century, but not until the 1970s did the first use of the official use of a pyramid really come to fruition. And that was in Sweden, in response to a kind of a national welfare crisis when there was a lot of food scarcity and a lot of economic turmoil. And a food cooperative educator put together this visual to help people understand how to make the most they could from their money and put different foods in different groups to demonstrate to people how to eat for the average consumer who didn't have a nutritional dietary background.
And I'm imagining the Swedish pyramid has a lot of herring down in the bottom of it. But
I think it did.
That's just
it,
a guess.
Yeah.
That's the idea of the pyramid, of course, that the sometimes foods are at the skinny end and the things which should form the bulk of the diet are at the base. But let's jump forward. For a while there, the US abandoned the pyramid and went to a plate. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the U.S. adopted a pyramid in the 90s based off of Sweden's pyramid. Other countries adopted a pyramid as well, kind of in the 70s to 90s, early aughts era. But in the Obama administration, they went back to a circle, which predates the pyramid in the United States and elsewhere. And not only is it visually just makes more sense, it's literally the shape of your plate most of the time. It also is a very easy kind of visual in terms of understanding percentages. Even if you're not a big math whiz, you can roughly understand, you know, 100% circle and what kind of portion of that should be, you know, what you're eating.
This much broccoli, this much sugar, this much meat.
Yeah, exactly. And the pyramid left a lot of that to, you know, pyramids are not something most of us use in our daily shapes in our houses and homes and visuals. So it was, you know, not necessarily useful. And it was very hierarchical, right? It created a hierarchy that wasn't always true, especially for every single eater. Whereas the plate added some democracy, if you will, to the system and just made it a little bit more visual. It also did away with the individual foods themselves. So no little pictures. It kind of just portioned it out, a green section for vegetables, a red section for meat. So it allowed people to interpret those things as they might for their own preferences, but also their own cultural needs, whether it's a vegetarian or a vegan or someone who abstains from a certain meat for religious reasons.
If you have a space for protein, you can fill that as you will.
Exactly, yeah.
So America has decided to go back to the pyramid, which in itself is somewhat retro, but the actual thinking and design of that refitted pyramid is also quite interesting. What happened and what's the timing of this and what drove this revision of dietary guidelines in the US?
Yeah, so our current administration was pushed in a large way by a group of voters that call themselves MAHA, the Make America Healthy Again movement, that really, you know, saw all these different food ways in America as problematic, very industrial food complex. That's the highly processed food or ultra processed foods, lots of packaged foods. And then a lot of the, they were really concerned with the meat industry and all the various additives or antibiotics or meds pushed into animals before they become meat. And then all the different vegetables, the way we grow and produce vegetables and fruits with pesticides and all these different things. So there's been a real push, and most of this originated online, mostly through social media. And this large base was partially responsible for electing our current administration and pushing to hire RFK Jr., who is our Health and Human Services Secretary, who was tasked to kind of revamp our entire food system. And there were lots of promises about getting rid of certain things that the rest of the world has already largely gotten rid of, like certain food dyes, which we've called problematic for a long, long time, but not, you know, the food industry wasn't necessarily keeping up, as well as some other additives or processes that the United States used in its agricultural systems that other countries have long abandoned.
The idea of acting against ultra-processed foods and, as you say, some of those additives, I mean, that's, in a dietary sense, that's all pretty sound, isn't it?
Totally. And it's one that most of us, scholars, nutritionists, average consumer, definitely get behind. But in the process, it went to the extreme. So you'll see that the pyramid is inverted and the thing at the top and the top left, and, you know, we're a left to right reading country. So the thing that's going to grab your eye the most is the top left part is protein, dairy, and healthy fats. And there's a big juicy red steak right at the top. And that imagery is not accidental.
You point out in your most excellent Substack pen knife, you point out that science was quite pointedly not the point of this US pyramid revision.
Absolutely. The drafters of this new food guide used existing nutritional guidance, because we did have some fairly sound nutritional guidance. It absolutely needed some updates. You know, we're constantly, the whole world is constantly, the scientific community is finding new things that help us understand more about our bodies and the food that we put into it. So to build off of that and come in with new research is totally fine. But a lot of the research that was implemented was based off of industry biases and personal gains. If you look in the white pages, kind of the data-driven research papers that they list at the bottom of the website, there are numerous advisors on the board that created these documents that are all backed by various industry big hats, basically. So you have a lot of money being pumped into the creation of this document from various meat corporations, various dairy corporations that are all at the top of this pyramid now. And, you know, that's a very telling thing. When a corporation is paying to tell people how to eat, that should ring a lot of alarm bells.
So it corporate interest is represented. I'm wondering, too, whether the skew of this new pyramid, if in fact you can skew a pyramid, whether that's of a piece with broader sort of social policy objectives of current US policymakers.
Absolutely. You see also in these white pages and also in the social media rollout of the new food pyramid, there's a real big push for the gender binary. There's a lot of discussion of testosterone, making the manliest man through what he eats, which is red meat, of course. There's a lot of conversation on women's reproduction and how to make a woman's body the best it can be to produce babies, which is a huge push for this current administration and trying to get more women to have babies. And then also prevent women from trying to not have babies. And I think visually too, you'll see when you start to pick apart the different types of foods that are represented visually on this pyramid and in the actual documentation, there's very little room for interpretation of cultural differences. Mm. Our makeup here in the United States, as it is in most other countries, is incredibly diverse. Huge immigrant populations that have also been here for a long, long time and are, you know, crucial parts of our foodways, whether it's from Latin America, Asian America, all over. And none of those things are really represented in these visuals.
So if you say protein and I say chickpeas, do I have a place in this pyramid?
I don't think you do. It's not clear on here. There's also a lot of push against vegetarian and veganism in the white pages of the new food pyramid documentation. It tells you different foods that you can eat to be a vegetarian, but that they are still not going to be as healthy or as life-giving as eating a steak, as eating protein from animals. There's lots of caveats in it.
Mm. So if we take the advice of this new pyramid, a daily intake might look like what?
On the whole, and I'm not a dietitian, I should also make that clear. I'm not a registered dietitian. I am a food historian and scholar. So analyzing the RDAs, the recommended daily allowances, are not necessarily something that I, you know, can speak to nutritionally, but they largely were the same. They didn't change a whole lot. They changed a little bit in terms of, from what I've heard from my fellow food scholars that do focus on that, that are registered dietitians, is that they amped up the protein intake for all individuals, but more for men than women. And they turned down the suggested macronutrients for fruits and vegetables and fiber. And more science is showing us that those should probably be reversed. You should prioritize fiber over protein. But again, it's all based on individual people. So I think for the large part, they didn't actually do a whole lot of new research. They didn't do a whole lot of new science to make some groundbreaking change saying, you know, oh, actually women need 1,000 more calories a day because of XYZ. They basically took out the bits that they didn't like and put a shiny new cover on top and said that they changed everything bad that Biden made before them.
I mean, it's interesting because the stated objectives become less fat, eat less ultra-processed food. That does not appear to be against anyone's interests.
Absolutely. No, it's very similar to, you know, RFK Jr. running on a campaign that he would get rid of food dye, and that's great. We want that to go largely away because we have known other countries have long before us shown us that some of these chemical food dyes are really bad for us. But we did not like the fact that he wanted to get rid of all of our vaccines. And so, you know, we're not sure we want to sign up for one if the other one is absolutely going to happen. So with this food guide change, the average consumer is not going to look at it. A lot of kids will see it in school. Posters will get put up. It's not going to feel like it's going to do much, right? But in fact, these pyramids and these guides, these white pages with all the data and all the science, those are hugely influential in everything from school food programs to supplemental assistance programs to agricultural industry subsidies. There's a huge cascade of effects that these new documents will have for potentially years to come.
So in that example you give there of food dyes as against vaccine, what's a parallel with the pyramid? We're getting rid of processed foods, but at the same time doing what?
I think the big one is the fiber versus protein. They're downplaying the importance of fiber, which we've known to be helpful in preventing cancers and all sorts of other biological problems. And in addition to just keeping the body running well, also downplaying the use and importance of grains and whole grains, which we know that our bodies need carbs to work. That's how our brains function, is carbohydrates. And prioritizing protein is a very clear, it's a concern, and it's a fact that it's also backed by tons of agricultural meat industry folks that are pumping money in to make sure that they get their cut.
That sort of influence is not unusual. Has the grain industry, for example, previously had an impact on earlier plates and pyramids?
Absolutely. So there was a disproportionate impact, and we definitely want to see some scrutiny over the way that industries can impact our nutritional guidelines, especially ones that are federally recognized and used in all these additional policies. So, you know, we're happy that the grain industry has maybe been put into its place a little bit, but in that process, they've let the meat industry rise. And I don't think that's going to be good for us in the long run either.
Now, as you write also, just take this historically, the notion of prescriptive eating, of telling people how to eat and using food to mold an idea of the model American citizen, that's a huge part of the American heritage.
It is, sadly. American foodways is in many ways built upon misguided and frequently racist interest in reforming other people's ways of eating. People would arrive in America as immigrants, and they were told, to be a proper American, you should eat this way. And, you know, at first it was done in this kind of dietary reformer, you know, we know better than you. We're from this advanced country, and this is how you're going to fit in. And, you know, you see that also played out in so many ways in the school lunchroom, where, you know, the new kid, no matter where they're from, their lunch is going to get made fun of. And all they want is to eat, you know, whatever, you know, was in vogue at that particular era in American foodways, peanut butter and jelly, a hamburger, whatever it is.
And as you say, this dips deep into the 19th century. This is not an innovation of a highly mechanized and consumerist society. This predates that significantly.
Absolutely. We have, you know, one of the biggest kind of push that we have documentation of was dietary reformers in the late 19th century telling Italian and Irish and Jewish immigrants that the only way to assimilate and fully become American was to adopt the standard American diet. They pushed wheat flour over cornmeal, or, you know, various types of vegetables that were nutritionally probably the same as vegetables that those immigrants might have eaten, but looked a different way. We see the same thing happen too with language and music and all sorts of things. And those things are obviously very detrimental to the soul and mental health, but there's a whole new level when you're taking away the food that people grew up eating and introducing other foods, or telling them that the foods that they grew up eating perfectly fine are actually wrong, or wrong now if they want to be American.
Writer, editor, and food scholar Casey Highsmith. From ABC Radio National, this is Every Bite. I'm Jonathan Green. So that's the situation in the United States. Here in Australia, we're due for our own shake-up of dietary guidelines. New recommendations are due later this year, and it's been more than 10 years since they were last updated. As mentioned, the last update included a switch from pyramid to plate. So let's ask an Australian expert, is the plate inherently better than a pyramid when it comes to promoting a healthy diet?
I think so, because it represents what people expect to see every day. They know what portions to put on their plate. People do not eat off a pyramid.
No, because it's been a long time since that happened.
My name's Phil Baker. I'm an associate professor at the School of Public Health for the University of Sydney. My research focuses on nutrition and food policy in Australia and globally. Dietary guidelines are a combination of science and politics in most countries. In the United States, they are definitely a product of the politics in this more recent version. In Australia, the situation is much different. It's much more of a scientific process. The National Health and Medical Research Council, which is responsible for developing Australia's dietary guidelines, did something really good. They set up a dietary guidelines committee, which is free from conflicts of interest. So this means that our dietary guidelines are being built upon the best possible science, reviewed by experts without any conflicts of interest and no industry influence whatsoever.
Because it's quite normal in the past, is it not, to have had industry representatives on committees like that?
That's right. In Australia's last dietary guidelines, back in 2013, there was actually a food industry lobbyist on the dietary guidelines committee. And that's actually been quite common in the United States as well, to have food industry right there in the committee involved in the decision-making process.
So as we look to the changes that might be brought later this year, and the timing is still somewhat uncertain and fluid, but what are your expectations of the new Australian healthy eating plate?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that the experts that are involved in the development of the Australian dietary guidelines are the best in the business. So I think we can have a lot of trust and faith in the committee to come up with the best possible recommendations based on the best possible available science. What we can possibly expect to see is the plate to continue. I can't confirm that. I have no interactions with the committee itself.
Maybe plate, maybe pyramid.
Yeah, I have a sense that we won't go back to the pyramid. I think we'll probably retain the plate. We'll also see something to do with animal versus plant-based foods, possibly something to do with ultra-processed foods. And we'll also see this focus on sustainability, we hope.
And sustainability is sort of a new element here in dietary guidelines.
That's right. In the 2013 Australian Dietary Guidelines, sustainability was considered by the committee that was developing those guidelines. With that industry influence, we think that was why the recommendations on sustainability were actually put into the appendix of the guidelines. They weren't made a main component of them. In this version of the dietary guidelines that will come out later this year, we're hoping that sustainability is integrated, as it should be, into the main dietary guidelines so that we're eating not just for our own health, but also the health of the planet as well.
How important is this? I mean, what sort of eating does a dietary guideline have influence over?
Well, these are not rules. This is not a prescription like you'd get from your doctor. These are guidelines, as it says in the title. So this is basically saying how we should eat in Australia, not actually how we do eat. And when you actually look at the diet of the Australian population, we're very far away from actually eating in a way that the guidelines recommend. I think it's something like 1 in 20 Australians get the recommended fruit and veggie recommendations, for example. But they are really important because what they do is they tell us what we should be aiming for, first of all. Second of all, they also provide a really important guideline for policymakers. So they tell policymakers what foods we should be providing in schools, for example, in our hospitals, in our prisons, to our military. They also guide things like food labeling. If we were to regulate the marketing of foods, for example, unhealthy foods, the guidelines would be there as well. So there are this wider influence on government policy that is really, really important to keep in mind.
And yet, as you point out, 1 in 20 Australians don't get their recommended share of vegetables or fruit. Is the problem there communication or something a little deeper?
I don't think it's so much a problem around communication, and it's not a lack of willpower or individual responsibility. It says more about the food environment in which people are living, in which they're working, in which they're growing up in, and we are surrounded by unhealthy, ultra-processed foods. It's also really, if you're time poor, if you're strapped for money, if you're a busy family, it can be, you know, really challenging to afford and prepare and feed your family healthy food. And these are barriers that we need to tackle through really good public policy in Australia. We need to make sure families have the income and the time and the support they need to, you know, source healthy food. We could also do things like change our school food programs. We could be getting healthy meals into schools, making sure Aussie kids have two, you know, healthy meals a day. There's some really game-changing things that we could do in these spaces.
Can dietary guidelines be somewhat too much of an absolute in a world in which people have, as you point out, all sorts of pressures and difficulties in meeting that standard?
Yeah, I think this is where, if you look at dietary guidelines all around the world, some of them are much better than others at sort of saying how to go about realizing the dietary guideline recommendations. So in some countries, they have like recipe books, for example. They give guidance to people around, you know, how you should go about shopping, how you can avoid unhealthy foods. They put a big emphasis on cooking, on food culture, and so on, which is guidance around, you know, how to integrate healthy food into your everyday life. And I think Australian dietary guidelines have done this to some extent, but it could be done a lot better.
It's a broader issue, is it not, than producing a new range of posters and snappy commercials?
Absolutely, absolutely. And like I said before, you know, it's about questioning our wider food system. We in Australia get about half of our calories from ultra-processed foods at the moment, somewhere between 40 and 50% of our calories. Our national diet is an ultra-processed diet. What does that say about our food system? What does that say about our society? That's something that the dietary guidelines are not going to fix. That's more of a structural problem that reflects the power of the ultra-processed food industry in our food system. It also reflects the lack of policy that's promoting healthy diets in Australia.
Pyramid or plate, chickpeas or steak, dietary guidelines occupy an interesting public space. Guidelines, not directives, but a serious cultural signal. Strange things happen when food becomes part of a culture war. But it gets even stranger when that same culture war has some worthy objectives, along with the frantic attempts to enforce some kind of hyper-patriotic culinary ideal. But then, if we are what we eat, maybe we shouldn't underestimate the power of the pyramid. Or plate. Your choice. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every Bite tells a story. And thanks to our guests, Casey Highsmith and Philip Baker. You can hear Every Bite on ABC Radio National and any time at all on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at everybite, or one word, at abc.net.au. Every Bite. At abc.net.au. We recently heard from Ricky, who told us our episode with Gurdeep Loyal struck a chord, which it would. Gurdeep's idea is that food is a kind of music. A musician himself, Ricky told us the harmony that he can now recognise in his go-to salad niçoise. He writes, "Just as a song uses a series of chords, so the niçoise presents me with a series of ingredient triads. Any single forkful may contain a combination of lettuce, tuna, tomato, potato, green bean, boiled egg, olives or anchovy, all of which work brilliantly together in clusters of three. Especially with the perfect fourth, a touch of lemony mustard dressing." If you missed that episode, you'll find it in our feed. It's called Flavours of Note. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by Kim Jerrick. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.